Everyone, good day, and welcome to the latest episode or session of the Ralph G. DePalma Memorial TBI Clinical Strategies Lectures. And today we have a great duo that will be speaking, and they will be speaking on the impacts of deployment trauma on photosensitivity and visual function. So the speakers today are Dr. Francesca Fortenbaugh. She is the principal investigator of TRACS, which is the Translational Research Center for TBI and Stress Disorders at VA Boston Healthcare System. Dr. Fortenbaugh is also an assistant professor of Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and an adjunct assistant professor at New England College of Optometry. Also is Dr. Jennifer Gustafson, Director of Advanced Low Vision and Blind Rehabilitation at VA Boston Healthcare System. Dr. Gustafson is also the investigator for Translational Research Center for TBI and Stress Disorders at Boston Healthcare System, and also as an instructor for Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Gustafson is a adjunct clinical faculty member at New England College of Optometry. So without further ado, I give you our pair of speakers today and in a very interesting talk that they'll be giving. Thank you.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Hopefully you can see our screens and hear us. I just like to, again, thank everyone for joining us to discuss the impact of deployment trauma, specifically mild TBI due to blunt force and blast-related trauma on photosensitivity and visual function. And with that, I'll pass it to Jen to start the overview.
All right. So Francesca and I are going to go over three studies looking at visual function in veterans with a history of mild traumatic brain injury. The first study we're going to look at is blast-related mild traumatic brain injury impacts on visual functioning. The second one's going to be on photosensitivity and common comorbidities. The third one is going to look at altered functional connectivity patterns seen on imaging in veterans with self-reported photosensitivity. And then we'll summarize with a couple comments for future clinical care and future research recommendations. All right, just some comments on background. Many of you would be familiar, but according to the CDC, there's approximately 2.8 million traumatic brain injuries that are occurring in the U.S. annually. This is in the civilian population with traumatic brain injuries. The majority of those are going to be mild. Approximately 80% and more are classified as a mild traumatic brain injury. If you look at the systematic analysis and or the systematic reviews and meta-analysis on what are the visual dysfunctions that happen with people after traumatic brain injury, a lot of those studies are done looking in the acute phase or several months after the injury. A lot of those studies, actually about a third of them, don't even report the time since injury. But those that do, 60% are doing those evaluations, you know, within the first 6 months, and over 70% are reporting within the first year. There's not a lot beyond that time period. What's been reported is a lot of accommodative insufficiency, convergence insufficiency, and visual field loss in the TBI patient population. Another thing that's not commonly reported delineated is, you know, what are the visual impacts that are happening in mild, moderate versus severe, like stratified. For those that are unfamiliar, accommodative insufficiency is when you start losing the ability to kind of focus at near, so you have blurry vision at near. Convergence insufficiency is when you have a difficulty bringing your eyes together. When you're looking far away, our eyes kind of go more parallel. When you start looking progressively closer, your eyes cross more and more. That's convergence. If somebody's having a hard time converging and they're off a bit, they can have blurred vision. If they're off by more than that, they can have double vision. If somebody's struggling to hold their convergence, they might tell you, I see movement of print, like when they're trying to read. Both of these groups would be complaining about eye strain and frequently like developing headaches when they're trying to read. So when we're looking specifically at mild traumatic brain injury, those visual symptoms are expected, you know, in the acute phase. The problem happens when we're talking about chronic deficits, and the medical community is split between, you know, whether they're going to accept that some of those deficits can persist chronically versus those who think that it's going to resolve. There is a handful of studies out there that are showing that some of these deficits can go on to be chronic. We can look at veterans with head injury that are going to the polytrauma clinics, and they're getting the neurobehavioral symptom inventory screen, and about 45% of those are reporting that they are experiencing problems with their vision. So whether that be photosensitivity or blur, trouble seeing, and a lot of those veterans are going to have mild, the majority are going to have, you know, mild traumatic brain injury. And also the majority of those are going to be, you know, in the chronic phase, many of them years post-injury. Another particular area is, you know, of interest would be, you know, the injury mechanism. Is there a difference in visual sequelae that happen depending on if the injury mechanism was a blast injury versus a blunt injury? And the literature is a little bit more undefined on if there is going to be a difference in the visual sequelae. So overall, a lot of work still needs to be done to validate that chronic visual dysfunction in mild traumatic brain injury and if injury mechanism plays a role.
Okay, great. So as we move into the first study here, since all of the studies we're going to be talking about today include participants from the TRACS cohort study, we wanted to take a couple minutes just to give an overview of the TRACS sample and the measurements that are collected as part of the standard testing battery in the TRACS study. This is an ongoing longitudinal cohort study of community-dwelling post-9/11 veterans that's been open for enrollment since 2010. All participants are given comprehensive assessments at the baseline visit or enrollment. And then these measurements are repeated again multiple times, the first at a 1 to 2 year follow-up, then a 5 year follow-up, and now 10 year follow-ups are being completed. Enrollment occurs at 2 sites. The primary site is Boston, with an additional site enrolling participants at the Houston VA, with over 1,000 post-9/11 veterans enrolled to date. General inclusion criteria for the TRACS cohort study, which will apply to any of the participants we're reporting on today, is that participants had to be post-9/11 veterans or active duty service members not yet deployed, with an age range between 18 to 65 years of age at the time of enrollment or their baseline visit. General exclusion criteria include neurological illness other than TBI, things like Parkinson's or dementia, seizure disorder unrelated to head injury, schizophrenia, bipolar, other psychotic disorders not related to PTSD, any issues with current active suicidal and or homicidal ideation requiring intervention, as well as cognitive disorders due to general medical conditions other than TBI. One of the unique aspects of the TRACS study is the detailed TBI and blast exposure history that's collected on all participants at enrollment and updated at any subsequent follow-up visits. And this is the Boston Assessment of Traumatic Brain Injury Lifetime, or BATTLE, which was developed at Boston VA and is a validated semi-structured clinical interview. It's administered by a doctoral level psychologist and results are reviewed in a weekly consensus meetings by at least 3 doctoral level psychologists before any history of TBI or blast exposures are recorded in the database. The interview provides information on TBI history in 3 different epochs. So TBIs are recorded whether they occur prior to, during, or after military service. And in addition to TBI, the battery collects information on blast exposures, which may or may not result in a subsequent TBI diagnosis. And blast exposures are sorted into three bins, those that occur or detonate within 10 meters of an individual, and these are classified as close blast exposures. And other exposures are classified as 10 to 25 meters or 25 to 100 meters. All of the data we're going to be reporting on today relates to the original battle scoring, but just to note here, this year, battle version 2.0 was released. There's a URL at the bottom of the screen in case anyone's interested. Updates include a more modular approach to reduce burden, the assessment of repetitive blunt and occupational blast exposures, since that's of increasing concern for the VA, as well as incorporating the new field standards for the diagnosis of TBI. The ACRM came out with a modified definition of TBI, mild TBI recently, so that the Battle 2.0 takes that into account. Just showing here a table of the broad array of measurements that are collected as part of the standard tracks battery. We won't be discussing all of these, but today I just like to focus now on the affective and psychosocial domain, as these measurements were collected at the same time as the visual measurements we'll be talking about in the remaining studies, and provide additional information about psychiatric and behavioral disorders from clinical interviews that provide diagnoses of current PTSD using the clinician-administered PTSD scale, as well as interviews for Axis I disorders, including depression, anxiety, substance use disorders. Also available were continuous measures of symptom severity. So for PTSD, we have the CAPS total score. For depression and anxiety, participants self-report using the depression, anxiety, and stress subscale. For current sleep disorders, we have the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index, which provides both a cutoff for current sleep disorder as well as a global score with higher values indicating worse overall sleep quality or more disruptions, and a measurement of chronic pain over the last month from the McGill Pain Questionnaire. So just to look at the subset of participants from the TRAC sample, we had a total of 31 participants who were able to go down to the eye clinic to have eye function exams with Jennifer between 2015 and 2017. Participants were not pre-selected based on any TBI or psychiatric characteristics, but eligibility for this additional aspect of the study included no history of moderate severe TBI, no history of retinal ocular disease, and no history of open globe injuries due to trauma. Jennifer was blinded as to the TBI and psychiatric history status of participants at the time of the eye exam. So to keep that in mind, and out of the 31 participants, it turned out that 14 did not have a history of blast-related mild TBI, while 17 did. And this sampling distribution gave us the opportunity to look at differences in visual function related to whether or not participants had a history of blast TBI during military service. Overall, while we're splitting the group this way, just to note that even though they may not have had a history of a blast-related mild TBI, a fair number, about 48% of 42% of the no blast TBI group did have at least one blunt force TBI during their lifetime, whether that was before or after military service. And in general, we did not see a higher rate of PTSD diagnosis across the two groups, but those in the blast TBI sample did tend to report slightly higher PTSD symptom severity scores. Okay, and I'll pass it back to Jen to discuss the measurements that were included.
Okay, so there was a variety of visual data that was collected on these participants, and this first study looks at more of like the visual functioning. The first thing that we did is we checked people's visual acuity monocularly, distance and near, using their habitual correction, so their glasses or contact lenses that were set for distance or near viewing distances. If somebody did not have 20/20 acuity, we used a pinhole down on the bottom right to show or to determine if their reduced acuity was related to refractive error or if it was related to more of like an Ock disease problem. Refractive error, if it was purely due to refractive error, then that acuity would then become 20/20. The next thing we did is we took a look to see what their refractive error would be, and we did this by looking at retinoscopy. Those are the pictures in the bottom left side. And so in this particular case, what we do is we shine a streak of light through the eye, and we look at the streak reflex that comes back through the pupil. And depending on the direction of movement through the pupil, we can objectively determine what somebody's refractive error is. Next, we looked at measurements of eye movements. We looked at fixation, we looked at pursuits, and then saccades. For pursuits, we checked it using the Onsuco method, pictures on the right, in which they track an object, a target, in two clockwise circles, followed by two counterclockwise circles, and they are judged based on their ability, accuracy, and if there's any head or body movement. Next, we looked at their saccadic function, and these are jump eye movements. An example of that is in the bottom left, in which there's two targets that are presented, and you direct the patient looking back and forth between the two targets, and you're looking to see if they are overshooting or undershooting that target. And these are judged based on their ability, accuracy, and if there's any head or body movement. The next thing we looked at was their ocular alignment. We did this by doing cover tests at distance and near. The pictures on the right show you a cover test. So cover tests can show you if they have a constant strabismus, an intermittent strabismus, or where their resting fovea posture is. We use that prism bar to neutralize the angle so we can see the magnitude of the deviation. Next, we look at their accommodation. So we do this monocularly, and we used the accommodative rule for doing this test. And there is a target on the other side of that card in which you move closer and closer to the patient's eye or the participant's eye until they report sustained blur. The top of that accommodative rule has your distance in centimeters. So you can take that centimeter result and you can convert that to a dioptric power of how much accommodative ability they had, their amplitude. Now, accommodation changes based on age. So the other thing that had to be done is we had to take the participant's age and calculate their minimum expected accommodative amplitude and then compare that to their accommodative result. And the next two we're going to discuss are some convergence tests. The first one is the near point of convergence. We also use the accommodative rule for that. Both eyes are open and they're viewing a target on the other side of that card. As you bring it closer, you're going to ask when that letter splits into two. At the point when the letter splits into two, that is called the break value. Alternatively, some people won't appreciate the break, but the evaluator will be able to see it because one of the eyes will stop tracking and will kick out. That is also considered the break value. As you start pulling the target away, you will ask them to say, you know, when that target goes back to one, and that's the recovery value. Alternatively, the evaluator can also see when that eye comes back in and goes into alignment. And then we also checked the positive fusional ranges, and we did this using a horizontal prism bar and a target. And in this case, you are increasing the amount of base out prism until the person reports blur, then double, and then you go ahead and reverse it the other way until they report they can make it single again, which is recovery.
Okay, so moving on to the results. performance for eye movements, ocular alignment, accommodation tests were compared to age-adjusted normative values and classified as normal or abnormal based on clinical cutoffs. So the table here is reporting the number of participants in each of the two groups who showed abnormal performance on these clinical measurements. For these tests, we found no difference in eye movements, ocular alignment, or accommodative amplitude across the two groups. Considering the convergence measurements, there was no difference found in the positive fusional versions. However, a greater proportion of veterans with blast-related TBI showed evidence of convergence insufficiency, with 70.6% or 12 out of 17 veterans in the blast MTBI group showing deficits on the near-point convergence task. Moving on to the measurements of resolving power. Blast MTBI was associated with poor distance acuity, but no difference was seen in the near acuity measurements across the two groups. For the refractive error measurements, using a linear mixed effects, considering the eye but not the age of the participants, no difference was seen in refractive error looking at it from this approach, but we further classified refractive error based on whether participants showed a myopic shift in refractive error. And for those who are unfamiliar, as I was when I started working with Jen on these projects, a negative refractive error in diopters would indicate a shift towards myopia, where light coming in from a distance is actually focused before hitting the back of the eye or the retina, so leading to a blurry image, whereas in hyperopia, light coming in from a distance would actually focus beyond where the retinal sheet is, again, leading to a blurry vision as well. This can be fixed with a negative refractive error lens in the case of myopia and a positive or concave lens in hyperopia as well. So using previous studies, we classified participants as showing myopia if their refractive error was equal to or greater than negative 0.5 diopters. And looking at the proportion of the sample that was myopic, we found a greater proportion of participants with a blast-related mild TBI showing myopia. If we compare this to a recent epidemiological study looking at the prevalence of myopia in the United States, and in particular focusing on the prevalence rates between 1999 and 2004, we can see that for the group without a history of blast mild TBI, prevalence rates of about 42.9% matched the general US population in the age range of the sample that we tested. While for the blast mild TBI group, we're finding approximately a doubling of that with 82.4% showing myopia. To look at this a little bit further, our next question was whether there was a relationship between the number and type of mild TBIs and refractive error. So for this, we conducted linear mixed effects models with eye, the left or right eye as a repeated measure. So across the 31 participants, we had 62 eyes to include in the model. Looking at the number of blast-related mild TBIs, which range from 0 to 2 in this sample, and considering the age of participants and the eye tested, we can see that for every blast-related mild TBI, we found about a negative 0.872 shift in refractive error. If we instead modeled using the number of non-blast or blunt force military TBIs, we did not find a significant relationship, nor if we considered the number of non-blast or blunt force TBIs across the lifespan. So in all these models, we are finding evidence for specificity in the relationship between mild TBI and myopia. That is, the greater number of blast-related mild TBIs, but not blunt force TBIs, is associated with greater myopia. As a second analysis, we wanted to look whether the number of mild TBIs in age is predictive of refractive error. So for this, we just took a cross-validation, leave one subject out approach using multiple linear regression. Here I'm showing the results from the regression using those three different classifications of our mild TBI measurement again. And we can see that the only model, again, that's significant is the one that considers the number of blast-related military mild TBIs and age as well in the model, with a Spearman's row of 0.323 showing the association between the observed and the predictive refractive error in diopters. As a final analysis here, we want to look at whether PTSD status impacts performance on the clinical measures or the self-report measures as well. So just showing here the self-report on the NSI questions across the two BLAST TBI groups, we can see that participants with a BLAST TBI reported greater trouble seeing, more issues with blurry vision, but no difference across the two groups in terms of their photosensitivity severity ratings. Within the no BLAST TBI group, six of the 14 participants, or about 43%, had a current diagnosis of PTSD. So if we reorganize the participants based on their current PTSD diagnosis, we can see that those participants with a current diagnosis of PTSD reported both greater issues with general vision, with blurry vision or trouble seeing, as well as higher severity symptoms for photosensitivity ratings. We compared that with the performance on the visual function measurements when we organized participants based on their PTSD diagnosis, and we found overall no differences. So participants with PTSD reported more severe visual symptoms, but did not demonstrate worse performance on tests of visual function.
Okay, so convergence insufficiency and accommodative insufficiency are the most commonly reported visual dysfunctions associated with mild traumatic brain injury in veterans. Our current results, and most of those studies are looking at less than a year post-injury, our current results are showing a high proportion of convergence insufficiency as measured by a reduced near point of convergence in the BLAST mild traumatic brain injury group at 70% versus 21% in the non-BLAST group. And this is in, you know, chronic mild traumatic brain injury. So this was years post-injury. All right, but there is still a lot of controversy surrounding chronic eye dysfunctions in mild traumatic brain injury, and even more controversy surrounding treatment recommendations. A few times a year, there is, you know, new publications that come out that are refuting some of the chronic visual impairments in mild traumatic brain injury in the chronic stage. So overall, additional work with high quality studies needs to be done to reach a consensus on the occurrence of persistent visual dysfunctions and what treatment options are available or are effective. And another a novel finding with this study that was a bit unexpected was the increased prevalence of myopia in the BLAST mild traumatic brain injury group that was associated with the number of BLAST-related mild traumatic brain injuries. You know, trying to wrap our head around what this could mean or why this could happen. You know, one potential theory could be, you know, is it post-traumatic pseudomyopia? There are reports of post-traumatic pseudomyopia in the civilian literature in case reports and small case series. And this is more related to an accommodative type dysfunction, in this case, an excess rather than an insufficiency. But future work would need to be done to validate and to look more into this increased prevalence of myopia. One, it would need to be validated on a larger sample study. Another thing would be looking at, you know, all the different reasons why somebody can go ahead and develop myopia, but we can look for the, you know, the post-traumatic pseudomyopia, you know, incorporating cycloplegic exams into the assessment to look for hyperopic shifts. We can look at axial length, we can look at corneal changes. There's different things we can look at for myopia. Another thing we would look at, you know, is whether these changes are going to be stable over time. And most of the time when we're talking about that, we're talking about, you know, is it going to get better over time? But in this case, because it's an accommodative excess thing, as people start reaching presbyopia, their accommodation is going down, down until eventually, you know, the accommodation's gone. So we can also see, you know, a change in pattern of their refractive error as time goes on. And if you look at kind of our, we didn't include it, but we have a scatter plot of what their accommodative dysfunction is based on their age, and we are seeing kind of a flattening there. So it is, I'm definitely very curious about post-traumatic pseudomyopia in this group. Another thing within this group is that, you know, the blast related TBI group reported much more commonly that they were having blurry vision than the non-blast group. And this can probably be explained that for whatever reason, our blast related group was not wearing the appropriate refractive correction. Yes, they probably would have a greater blurry vision. But then between those two groups, there was no significant difference between the photosensitivity symptoms. Mm-hmm. This is in contrast to like when we look at our PTSD, as Francesca said a moment ago, if we look at the PTSD positive versus the PTSD negative group, we see that their visual dysfunction is equal between the two groups, but in the group with PTSD, they're reporting a much higher severity level of impairment with their visual functioning. So given, you know, given that information, we wanted to take a look at what the relationship is between photosensitivity, symptom severity, mild traumatic brain injury, and the common comorbidities. And we wanted to put that into a much larger sample, like the larger TRACS cohort. So photosensitivity is a very commonly reported issue following mild traumatic brain injury in veterans, with over 50% reporting photosensitivity in the acute phase. This is another one where people are kind of split. So the general thought for a long time was that, you know, these mild symptoms, they resolve, including the vision ones. So we expect them to resolve within a few weeks to a few months. But there's an ever-growing report in the literature with photosensitivity as well that it can also persist months and years after the injury. Looking at a chart review, and a civilian eye clinic found that 26% of the case, or 26% of the time, they couldn't find anything that accounted for their photosensitivity symptoms. They couldn't find a potential cause. One thing to think about would be looking at sensory hypersensitivity, in which photosensitivity could be considered there. And it's been proposed to be a transdiagnostic factor for mental illness, stress, and burnout. So could these unaccounted cases of photosensitivity symptoms be reflected in those common comorbidities?
Right. So for the second study, we looked at the larger TRACS database that was available at the time, and excluded participants who had a history of moderate to severe TBI, missing data on the measurements we were interested in looking at, and those who failed an effort or validity measurement on the medical symptom validity test, given that our photosensitivity measure will be relying on a self-report question from the NSI. So for this, we had 641 participants available, and we split them based on whether or not they had a history of military mild TBI, not blunt specific, not blast specifically. It could be either blast or blunt force related. Just to note here, across the sample, we did not find a difference in the age of participants across the yes/no military TBI group, but we did find a greater proportion of male participants in the group who had a history of military TBI. Looking across some of the common psychiatric and behavioral comorbidities, we can see across the board, participants who had a history of mild TBI during military service had greater rates of current diagnoses for PTSD, as well as greater symptom severity for PTSD, anxiety, depression, poor sleep quality, and higher rates of average pain, and also reported greater issues with headaches or more frequent headaches. We're going to be focusing here on the question from the neurobehavioral symptom inventory, which asks people to report their sensitivity to light and the extent to which it's bothered them during the last 2 weeks. And I'm reporting out here the different categories of responses that are possible if you're not familiar with the NSI questionnaire. Over 50% of the sample reported no issue, which is, you know, photosensitivity rarely, if ever present, not a problem at all. About 20% reported mild, which would be occasionally potentially having some issues with light sensitivity, but importantly, that does not disrupt the ability to complete any activities of daily living, and the participant does not find the photosensitivity concerning. In contrast, about 185 or 28.8% of the sample reported at least some level of functional impairments related to photosensitivity by endorsing either moderate to very severe symptoms. The first thing we wanted to look at was the relationship between a positive diagnosis of military mild TBI and current PTSD on photosensitivity ratings. We ran ANCOVA that included age and sex of participants as covariates. We found first a main effect of the history having a positive history of mild TBI that can be seen, as well as a main effect of current PTSD diagnosis. And interestingly, no interaction between the two factors. If anything, we were finding evidence for an additive impact of these two diagnoses, where relative to having neither, having a single diagnosis of either a military mild TBI or current PTSD was associated with about a 0.5 point increase in the age and gender adjusted photosensitivity ratings, while having both conditions together was associated with about a 0.65 to 0.68 increase relative to either condition alone. This replicates previous findings that have been reported in mixed TBI severity samples. And our next question was, what about the other comorbidities that we see differences across the two groups? So for this, we wanted to consider the impact of repetitive military mild TBIs, or the number of mild TBIs participants had experienced, as well as the severity of common comorbidities on this photosensitivity symptom severity ratings. We calculated a multiple ordinal regression model, given that there were only 5 potential outcome values for the photosensitivity rating. And we can see the results of that regression model here. We find that overall higher photosensitivity ratings are associated with a greater number of mild TBIs, higher anxiety and PTSD symptoms, and greater or worse sleep quality. And we note that previous studies have found that the avoidance or numbing PTSD subscale was associated with photosensitivity ratings in a blast exposed veteran sample with mild TBI. Here we're looking at the CAPS total score as our PTSD symptom severity rating. So we wanted to look out what would happen if we instead defined PTSD using the subdomains of the CAPS for the re-experiencing, avoidance, and numbing and hyperarousal subscales. What we can see from the results of the regression models here is that consistently across the board, the number of mild TBIs is positively associated with photosensitivity ratings. For each mild TBI, we're seeing about a 0.22 increase in photosensitivity ratings. We also find that anxiety and sleep quality are consistently associated with increased photosensitivity ratings. And considering the different ways PTSD was considered in the different subdomains, we find that really it's the hyperarousal symptoms of PTSD that are positively associated with photosensitivity ratings here, while the severity scores for re-experiencing and the avoidance numbing subscale were not significantly associated with the photosensitivity ratings in this sample. To follow up on this, we asked the question of whether the impact of PTSD subdomains depends on the type of mild TBI modeled, whether it's any TBI or blast related, as the previous study we mentioned specifically focused on blast exposed veterans. So we reran the last two regression models, including the number of blast TBIs as our TBI measurement here. The results showing that we're still seeing an association with hyperarousal symptoms, but not with avoidance numbing. And for each blast TBI, we're seeing now about a 0.48 increase in photosensitivity ratings. We did see that the blast, or that the military mild TBI group did have more close blast exposures than the no military TBI group. So we reran the regression one more time to see whether blast exposures would impact photosensitivity ratings. And interestingly, the number of close blast exposures was not a significant predictor of photosensitivity. But even in this case, the hyperarousal symptoms of PTSD were still significantly associated with photosensitivity ratings. So just to summarize here, our results are replicating previous findings that veterans with a history of mild TBI and current PTSD report higher or worse photosensitivity symptoms than veterans with either condition alone. We're further showing a positive association between the severity of photosensitivity symptoms and the number of mild TBIs, current PTSD and anxiety symptoms severity, as well as greater sleep disturbances. Across our models, current depression symptom severity was not found to be a consistent predictor of photosensitivity ratings. This conflicts with some of the previous work on sensory processing difficulties as a general risk factor for mental illness, but it is consistent with other work in healthy individuals showing that reduced contrast sensitivity is associated, is found in patients with depression or major depressive disorder. So whether the association between depression is in the more sensory avoidance or sensory seeking aspect of these sensory processing disorders, there's additional work that needs to be done to really understand the link between these conditions. One of the big findings here was the association between photosensitivity symptoms and PTSD symptom severity was primarily driven by hyperarousal symptoms in our sample. There are some limitations, which include the lack of a detailed migraine history from participants, but high rates of headaches reported in the background questionnaire across the mild TBI groups. Just to note, to address this issue, TRAX has added the migraine disability assessment test, which was added in 2018, so not enough participants had that data to really be included in this particular analysis. The other is the issues that can arise from using a self-report measure, like a single question from the NSI. There currently is not an objective measurement of photosensitivity that is used in clinical settings. There are some quantitative measurements that other labs have used, and I know there are some labs at the VA that are currently working to develop objective measurements that can be reliably used. So we'll see how those works develop in the future. But given that we are relying on a self-report measurement, and the work here is showing that many common behavioral and psychiatric comorbidities are associated with worse photosensitivity ratings, along with a number of TBIs, we wanted to see if we could look at the MRI scans that are collecting TRAX participants and see whether we could find sort of an objective measurement that correlates with these self-reported photosensitivity ratings that is not accounted for by all of these other associated conditions. So moving into our last study here, when we're thinking about the neurobiological basis of photosensitivity, a definitive photosensitivity pathway has not been defined in the literature yet. However, there are several potential neural pathways that are believed to be involved in photosensitivity and that have good support from both human studies as well as animal models of photosensitivity and photophobia related to different conditions like migraine, dry eye, and TBI. These include the retino-midbrain parasympathetic pathway, the retinothalamocortical pathway, and the retino-hypothalamic pathway. think about the anatomical locations and structures involved in these pathways. These early visual and nociceptive pathways are not going to be readily captured by fMRI protocols at the resolution that we're using here. We're likely not going to see activations or changes in functional connectivity patterns or really be able to isolate some of these small nuclei. However, it's known that many other cortical and subcortical networks are involved in pain perception and our awareness of pain. So areas like the insula are known to be involved in pain perception. Areas like the default mode and attention networks are known to dynamically change their connectivity patterns as people focus on or away from chronic pain. And at that level of those cortical networks, we may be able to identify regions that are predictive of whether people are reporting photosensitivity symptoms. So looking at the participants who had MRI data available, a subset of 291 TRACS participants were available for the analysis. As before, these participants had no history of moderate severe TBI, had completed the NSI questionnaire, and did not fail the MSVT effort measure. Within this, we defined two groups, a total of 204 participants. We had participants who had no photosensitivity. These would be participants who endorsed none or zero rating on the NSI questionnaire. And then we defined our yes photosensitivity group based on previous studies that have looked for actual functional impairments related to NSI question severity ratings. And this would be 61 participants who reported either moderate, severe, or very severe issues related to photosensitivity. For this 204 participants, we were able to define a parcellation in the brain from using the Power et al. Atlas, which is defined from functional tasks and resting state connectivity with some additional subcortical nodes related to emotional processing and emotional regulation that were included. The regions of interest were all 10 millimeter spheres that span sort of cortical, subcortical, and cerebellar regions. For each of these 277 regions of interest, we calculated the average time series across the 12 minutes of resting state scan that we had. And for all pairs, we calculated the Pearson's correlation coefficient across those two time series. So in this case, for region A and region B, we would get a correlation of negative 0.621 for that. We then defined the Pearson correlation coefficient for all pairwise combinations of nodes across our parcellation. So for each subject, we would get a matrix that looks something like this, a 277 by 277 matrix. And for each participant, we would then create a vector containing all the correlations for all unique pairings of the two ROIs, or essentially the upper triangle of the matrix since it's symmetrical there. This leaves us with a potential feature set of over 38,000 connections across the brain. And the question is, how do we build a parsimonious model out of this? So our next step then is to use a data-driven iterative feature selection approach using cross-validated leave one out procedure, which varies the number of feature set sizes. We then use a naive Bayes classifier to predict the subject that's left out and iterate until all participants are classified for a given feature set size. So here I'm showing the bar for a single feature. That's where our model would start and say, okay, kick one participant out with the participants left in. You can only pick one connection. Find the best connection that would define the two groups. Get the weights. Now predict the subject that was left out and do that 204 times. We get an average accuracy of about 65% for one feature. Now force it to include two features. Prediction drops to 50. Three features, it starts to go back up. And we can look at the mean accuracy across all participants for the first 102 iterations here. We find that the best model includes seven features with our over model accuracy at 74%. Using Monte Carlo permutation testing, our model is significant at p less than 0.001. We can ask whether our model is biased towards one group or the other. So here I'm plotting the mean classification accuracy for the participants without photosensitivity, shown as the black line, and those with photosensitivity as the red line. We can see our seven feature model does pretty well for both groups. Here I'm going to show the connections in the seven feature model. We can see that we get a lot of connections visual to visual, visual to cerebellum, and insular areas here. This gives us 13 nodes or regions of interest that were used to create our feature model. The red dots here show the locations of those 13 nodes here. We wanted to understand what are these areas of the brain typically associated with. So first, we can note that four of the areas are extra striate visual areas, probabilistically in the area of V3, V5, in those areas there. We have one region that would fall within the default mode network. And interesting, we found two meta-analyses related to pain perception. The first is a 2016 meta-analysis of all fMRI studies looking at painful stimulation. The second is a neurosynth meta-analysis of 516 studies that incorporate the study of just pain as a general topic. And we can see that all eight of the remaining nodes fall within areas that have been associated with pain perception or pain processing. This is interesting, but as our final analysis, as we wrap up here, we wanted to ask whether these connectivity patterns are specifically predicting photosensitivity or whether they're merely reflecting the presence of comorbidities that are commonly seen in this sample. Looking across the two groups, we can see that participants in the yes photosensitivity group had higher rates of PTSD diagnosis, military mild TBI, current depression, anxiety, pain, sleep, as well as reporting more headaches, with no difference in substance use disorder. So to address this, we ran a discriminant analysis using a leave one subject out cross-validation to see if these seven connections we find were in fact predictive of these other diagnoses. I'm showing here the mean accuracy or classification for photosensitivity. It should be high. We selected these features to be predictive of photosensitivity. What about the others? We find that for all of these other conditions, our model is not significantly predicting better than chance, PTSD, TBI, anxiety, sleep, or even headaches. We were able to get a new set of 29 participants who were not included in the original feature selection approach, and we can see predicting photosensitivity ratings in this group. Average accuracy was 68%, which is higher than predicting any of the other comorbidities in the original 204. So this indicates some level of specificity of functional connectivity patterns related to photosensitivity, and these alterations are not just reflecting the psychiatric or behavioral comorbidities. So wrapping it up here.
Okay, so in summary, for any clinicians out there, inquire about photosensitivity or binocular vision impairment symptoms in your traumatic brain, your mild traumatic brain injury patient, and also a multidisciplinary team approach is strongly encouraged in that patient population. For researchers, we do need to do continual work to understand the neurological basis of photosensitivity and also develop measures of photosensitivity that, like objective measures of photosensitivity that can be used easily in the clinic setting. In regards to binocular vision dysfunction in chronic mild traumatic brain injury patients does not have consensus amongst the medical community. In order to get this consensus, we need to work on some large-scale studies that minimize risk of bias. We need large-scale, multi-center, multidisciplinary OD, MD, randomized controlled trials, where the evaluator is blind to the mild traumatic brain injury status of the patient. I think only in doing these good quality studies will consensus be reached in the case of a mild brain injury. in terms of the prevalence, absence, or absence or presence, and the prevalence of these visual dysfunctions. We also need to do these studies to start looking at the natural history of visual impairments in mild traumatic brain injury. How many of these are going to go on to recover on their own? How many of them are going to be persistent? We need to follow them chronologically and start determining, are there any predictive factors for who's going to recover and who's not? And then lastly, we really need to look at high quality studies, looking at which treatments are effective for treating binocular vision dysfunctions. Overall, Francesca and I believe the VA is uniquely positioned to assess the multifaceted impact of neurologic, psychological, and behavioral disruptions that can impact sensory functioning in an individual with mild traumatic brain injury.
And with that, we would just like to thank the funding as well, and for TRACS, Directors William Milberg and Co-Director Catherine Fortier. And TRACS is a large multi-disciplinary team. There's many investigators, collaborators, postdocs, research assistants, both past and present, who have made this large data set possible. And we'd like to acknowledge Dr. Jenilyn Jody, who completed the second study we described here as part of her master's thesis at New England College of Optometry, and a VA fellowship in optometry as well. Thank you.
Thank you to both our presenters. I'd just like to turn things over to Dr. Hoffman first for comments and questions.
It's a very nice presentation. This presentation is open for questions. I have one I would like to ask first.
Sure.
This is a little bit of a sort of like listening to your presentation, it sort of prompted me to think about other types of sensory disorders after mild TBI. So it's sort of from left field, but could this type of photosensitivity almost be the equivalent of what would be a visual equivalent for what would be tinnitus in the auditory system in some ways?
I think people make that claim, but I don't know if it's fully backed. So there's a handful of studies that look at tinnitus, and that sometimes we extrapolate that to include photosensitivity, but there's not the true research scientific backing to make that jump. But yes, it is, that jump is made all the time, but I don't think it's valid, and I don't think it's supported in the research.
Okay, thank you. Are there any additional questions?
So I'm not seeing any questions now in the chat or Q&A. You guys did it so well, there are no questions. So that's wonderful, right?
I don't know whether it's me because I'm one of the moderators, but I could not send my my question. I sent it through chat, then I tried to send it through the Q&A, but it would not go for me. The buttons are still glitched out.
Oh, no. We'll have to definitely address that. That it was working beforehand. But we are almost at the top of the hour. So right now, if Jennifer and Francesca, if you guys have any closing comments for our audience today?
No, I guess, some of the conversations that I have in terms of binocular vision, I should say, I kind of look at it from two perspectives. I'm a clinician working with these things and also a researcher on the other side. Like, if I look at things clinically, I would say that it does seem to be very true that these binocular vision impairments do seem to be longer lasting in the mild traumatic brain injury group. And I also do vision rehab of those specific conditions that were discussed today, mostly the accommodative and convergence stuff. And I find success there, but I also agree with the people that are more skeptical out there that there's not really great research backing that shows that my clinical perception, my clinical expertise, is matching, reality. And I do think additional good studies are really needed to support those things.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Hoffman, I think you were about to say something earlier.
Yeah, it was more of like an imaging question. Do you find there's that long fasciculus from the occipital lobe to the frontal? Do you see any decrease in white matter integrity along that pathway in the population that's has these issues?
That's an interesting question. We haven't looked at any of the DTI data yet, but that is definitely something that we could look at, especially since we didn't describe it here, but the majority of these participants are, years post any sort of mild TBI blast exposure. I think on average about 6 years post, since they're several years post deployment. So these effects are chronic in cases, so it might have had the time to start to show up on the DTI measurements. There's still a lot of questions about, what DTI variables are sensitive to other, to the neurotrauma measurements, to the psychiatric, if at all. But I think we now have some idea of some specific targets. If we're seeing differences in functional connectivity, is that actually associated with changes in structural connectivity, which we could see with the DTI measurements? So, an interesting next step.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, Whitney. Do you want to close us out, Whitney?
So, thank you so much to our presenters for presenting today, and thank you, Dr. Hoffman, for being here. To our attendees, when I close out the meeting, you'll be prompted with a feedback form. Please take a few moments to complete the form. We really do appreciate and count on your feedback to continue to deliver high-quality cyber seminars. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's HSR cyber seminars, and we look forward to seeing you at a future session. Have a great day, everyone.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.